From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. And first, we are joined by science journalist Lauren Young to talk about a recent Scientific American article that explores how GLP-1 drugs, like Ozempic, quiet the food noise. But how?
Very interesting conversation. We're learning so much about these GLP-1 drugs, even as the weeks wear on. It's fascinating. And then we speak with scuba diving philosopher Peter Godfrey Smith. He shares a story called Living on Earth, Forests, Corals, Consciousness, and the Making of the World. He speaks to us from Australia, where he is a professor in the program called The Philosophy of Science. If you've never heard of that, it's a very interesting one. Stay tuned. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Appetite, the drive to eat, is biologically motivated by three core sensations: hunger, fullness, and reward. Now, remember those three as we enter our next conversation. The not-so-new drugs, weight loss drugs like Ozempic, are now surrounding us. We all know someone who has been treated with one of these drugs. But how do they really work? Joining us now is journalist Lauren Young. She is an associate editor for health and medicine at Scientific American, and she's written a recent article in Scientific American titled Ozempic Quiets Food Noise in the Brain, But How? Lauren, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us. This is such a big current topic. We have really looked forward to sort of getting the ins and outs of this. First of all, what is food noise?
Right. So food noise, actually, there's no real scientific definition of this, but this is kind of this anecdotal observation that a lot of people using drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy, which is the weight loss version of Ozempic, it's the same drug, just a different name, and made by the same company. And a lot of users of these medications have been noticing as they've taken the drugs, like, you know, not only am I, you know, experiencing this weight loss, but all those, you know, intense cravings I used to have are kind of silenced all of a sudden. Researchers are trying to piece together the puzzle of why this is. And it kind of goes back to this hormone that this drug is modeled after. So that's a little bit about what food noise is. Like, I have had spoke to a couple patients. Like, yeah, there was this one patient who said, I always used to have this intense, popcorn was my most intense craving. But suddenly I would just walk by a popcorn bowl and, like, I no longer experience that, you know, constant need for food, where food kind of, I guess, just predominates your thoughts. That's sort of the idea of food noise.
Right, right. So this is so important. So again, drugs like Wegovy and Ozempic mimic the effects of this hormone called GLP-1. It doesn't even matter what it stands for. It's probably some really long word.
It is quite a long acronym. It stands for glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1. And this is a natural hormone that everyone makes. We all actually produce kind of a baseline level of this, but it is actually one of many gut hormones that are involved in things like food digestion, and aiding the movement of food throughout the digestive system. But it also plays a really important role in moderating insulin levels. And that's actually the primary reason that researchers were really interested in this hormonal pathway back in around the 1980s. This is when researchers were really targeting this hormone, along with other hormones that do very similar things to GLP-1, trying to understand, okay, well, basically, the way that GLP-1 works is it's an incretin hormone. So, and what incretin means is when you eat food, in response to food, this hormone produces or prompts the production of insulin. And insulin is obviously a really important hormone that helps control blood sugar levels. So researchers were interested in this hormone because of that. And so essentially the main pathway of GLP-1 in the gut. And this is where it gets a little bit complicated. So hopefully you can hang on there with me as I explain this. So when you eat food, you eat a meal, it goes through your digestive system. And then when it hits the intestines, so it's breaking down into, you know, the various molecules, that nutrients and everything, and you're absorbing that food into your body. But once it hits the intestines, that's when GLP-1 starts to increase in your body. And so as it increases in the body, that signals to both the pancreas to produce insulin, but it also latches onto this long cranial nerve in the body that communicates with organs as well as up to the brain. It's called the vagus nerve. And the GLP-1 also attaches there. And that sends basically another signal to the pancreas like, hey, we need you to pump up insulin because we're eating food, glucose levels are rising, and that essentially helps bring it back down.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation about Ozempic and its effects in our brains with Associate Editor for Health and Medicine at Scientific American, Lauren Young. But Lauren, I was talking with a friend the other night at dinner who has just started this, and he was saying how he just doesn't have the interest in food. And it's not the same as being satiated. So as people use this drug, they're losing their interest in food, but they're not satiated. And there's a big difference. I mean, what is the difference between, again, disinterested and satiated?
That's actually really interesting because as scientists understand how this drug works is that, and thank you for breaking up the satiated part, the satiety, because in addition to helping regulate insulin, as the hormone itself is latching onto that vagus nerve, it's sending a signal up to the brain. And researchers know that it is a satiety signal. And what satiety essentially means is, and what it's resulting in this weight loss effect, is it's basically telling your body that you're full. Like, hey, stop eating. You've eaten too much. And so what this results in a lot of patients is you're eating one smaller meals and less frequent meals. And that ultimately is one of the primary reasons people are experiencing this weight loss while on these medications. But that's really interesting in terms of losing interest versus satiety, because obviously, and patients do note this, it's not that they're losing hunger. You know, you still experience that feeling of like, I'm hungry for food. That doesn't go away. And that's because that process is actually controlled by an entirely different hormone called ghrelin, which is one of the main hunger hormones. And what GLP-1 and a variety of other satiety hormones does with ghrelin is it kind of like works in opposition to each other. So they're checks and balances. So these drugs aren't affecting, hunger. So people will still feel like, oh, I want to eat. It's basically helping you while you are in the eating process to kind of help control a little bit. So maybe that's what's going on there in terms of the loss of interest a little bit.
Well, I think that loss of interest they're finding is really actually working well for things like addictive behaviors with alcohol, possibly nicotine. Mm. Tell us about that, because again, this started out as a diabetes drug and now it's worked into a weight loss drug. And so we're starting to understand that Ozempic and these other drugs can help addictions and compulsive behaviors, which all have a tie to dopamine and dopamine receptors. So is Ozempic actually affecting our dopamine cravings in the brain?
Yeah, this is the question that a lot of researchers are trying to piece together. And as you mentioned, there's been a lot of these anecdotal reports of people who are using these drugs experiencing, you know, hey, no longer experiences sort of this compulsive need to drink alcohol or to consume nicotine or to gamble, things like that. And the reason why researchers are trying to understand this is, well, one, GLP-1 receptors. So the way that GLP-1 works, obviously, is it and the way that these drugs work, too. And again, these drugs mimic the hormone and they last a lot longer than the regular hormone. So that was like the whole issue with the original diabetes medications is making them last longer in the body. So researchers have a hunch that, you know, as these drugs are lasting longer in the body, they might be acting potentially on the brain a little longer. So not only might it be affecting, you know, things like satiety, but the receptors are found everywhere in the brain. According to one of my researchers at University of Pennsylvania, he's like, they're really found everywhere, not only in just the brain, but in the body. So clearly when these drugs are binding to these receptor sites, there's some that are located in regions of the brain that are affiliated with things like reward and pleasure. And there's been a couple studies looking at basically when you have these GLP-1 drugs, quote unquote, on board, or someone's taking them, usually you see a spike in dopamine when you eat food, but also when you are consuming things like opioids or you know, other types of substances that might induce that dopamine spike. But when you are taking these GLP-1 drugs, that spike gets squelched. So there's something interesting here about how these drugs might be reducing that pleasure reward pathway, if you will. When you're taking these drugs.
That's a really interesting point, Lauren, because I think there are many people out there that don't want to take antidepressants because it takes out those highs. It takes out the lows, but it takes out the highs too. And so I'm wondering if in some ways, looking at, you know, increasing this hormone, the satiety hormone, GLP-1, in the brain, if that is counteracting, you know, what dopamine does, which is when we feel love, we get a dopamine hit, and that's a good thing. So there are a lot of good things that might be also being repressed. Is that fair to say, or is there research around that?
That's a really good question too. And I don't think we have enough research there to really understand that question. But it's interesting because it is so complex, and we're definitely finding out about this drug a bit in real time as more like millions of people continue to use them. But I have heard of that, you know, report from patients saying, like, there was actually a researcher who said, like, life might feel boring on these GLP-1 drugs. And it kind of exploded a little bit, that reaction, because, you know, a lot of other patients say that it's not true. And that in general has been a very interesting part of the story for me, is, and something that a lot of researchers are trying to figure out, is why the reaction to the drug is so different between different people. You know, some people are, you know, experience a lot of nausea on these drugs. That's a big side effect. Some gastrointestinal issues, and that causes them to stop taking the drug. Some people experience, I think it was, I want to say like 18% of people lose 5% of weight, and that's considered an insignificant amount of weight loss. And people, researchers are also trying to figure out why the drugs aren't effective in that department. So I think there's still a lot of questions in, you know, in people's reactions to these drugs, both in the brain and in the body.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, when you were talking about what the GLP-1 hormone does as a satiety hormone that makes you feel satiated, when there is someone, well, I wonder if there is research that shows people who have high levels of the GLP hormone, if they are the folks who are, you know, those naturally skinny folks who, no matter how much they eat.
That is also another million-dollar question. one of my researchers said that, Giles Yeo, wonderful researcher out in England, and he was like, that is one of the big questions is, you know, are there differences too? I mean, there are some studies that have shown that there are varying levels in people's natural production of GLP-1, the regular hormone that you kind of start out with without using these drugs. So there might be some difference there as to why, or figuring out who might be producing more or less naturally. That is the question. And we also don't know too, if by producing less GLP-1, it means that you might be more at risk of diabetes or obesity. That is still a question up in the air. But we do know, researchers do know, that there are some baseline differences between people. But that is a very big question, and one that I was really curious about too, but I think it's still early stages.
Well, Lauren, one of the big questions I think a lot of people have, but nobody really seems to be able to answer yet, is the long-term effects. Because you know, it, like we said, it's been used for diabetes treatment, and now it's being used for weight loss and possible other things. And it hasn't really been around that long. So are they concerned about any sort of long-term, even addiction to this drug, because it's having an effect chemically in your body, and you go off of it, that chemical is going to be desired somehow.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure about the addictive effects of Ozempic and Wegovy. I don't, and semaglutide, which is the name of the generic drug. I'm not quite sure if that's been investigated, but it is true that these drugs, in terms of Ozempic and Ozempic specifically, that drug has only been approved since 2017. So it hasn't been around exactly that long. What we do know, one of the main things we do know about using these drugs is that for diabetes particularly and for obesity, they are considered lifelong drugs. So these people who are using them, the idea is that they're on them for the rest of their lives, this medication, in order to, for diabetes, control their glucose levels and, for weight loss to help with that. So we do know, though, when you are taken off the drug for weight loss specifically, a lot of people experience gaining the weight back. So there's that. But in terms of the long-term effects and withdrawal or anything like that I haven't quite seen in my research, but there could be studies, and currently investigating that. But yeah, I don't I'm not quite sure if there's concrete answers just yet.
Well, two questions, the two-part question. Was the GLP-1, was this first discovered with these drugs? And if so, is there another way, or is somebody working on a different, maybe safer way to help regulate the GLP-1 hormone versus, instead of having to take this long-term drug that has all these other side effects?
Sure. Yeah, and just to be clear, the drugs are safe. They've been FDA approved, and everything, and they've gone through tests. But obviously, the long-term effects are a huge question, no doubt. But they are safe to use. I haven't seen too much there in terms of safety. So they are safe in that regard. But in terms of the first question on whether GLP-1 was discovered in conjunction to the drugs, actually, we've known about GLP-1 for quite some time. I can't remember the exact date. I want to say it was in the 70s, maybe 60s, when they first identified GLP-1. And it was actually, I want to say, an anglerfish. They found out about this hormone, which was really interesting to find out. But yeah, so we've known about the hormone for quite some time, and trying to narrow in, okay, like what is it doing in the human body, both for its effects on insulin, and then later on for satiety. I think it was like in around 1996 that they figured out that the drug, or not the drug, the hormone can influence things like satiety and food intake. So that was the answer to the first question. And repeat the second question again, if there's new drugs, is that?
Yeah, are they working on another way to work with the GLP-1 hormone that maybe is not as complex or with the same side effects as Ozempic?
Right, yeah. So there's a bunch of different, because this huge boom in popularity of these medications, a lot of companies have been invested in their own version. So the latest new version is by Eli Lilly. They have this drug called tirzepatide. Its brand names are Mounjaro and Zepbound. Mounjaro being the diabetes medication, and Zepbound being the weight loss medication. And that drug, what's really interesting is I feel like we're seeing more companies trying to target multiple of these gut hormones at once, instead of many of these early, what we have now, and even the earlier iterations of these medications focused on GLP-1, this one main hormone. But now we're starting to see these drugs sort of target multiple different gut hormones at once. So that's what tirzepatide does. It's targeting both GLP-1 and GIP, which is another incretin hormone. And that's causing a little bit more weight loss than you see with other drugs, with Wegovy and Ozempic. And then similarly, there's other drugs that are on the horizon that are doing similar things. Like there's another one, I think, that Novo Nordisk is developing called CagriSema, which is combining both semaglutide, GLP-1 target, and amylin, which is another hormone. So I think that particular drug actually induces, last I saw trial-wise, that one induces a lot of nausea. So I think there's still more developing to do in terms of the side effects. And one of my researchers, Matthew Hayes at University of Pennsylvania, the nausea aspect and the GI issues that some people might experience while utilizing these drugs, who could really benefit from these drugs, that's a huge area of research and trying to improve that. And whether maybe it's, you know, some people take a combination of Wegovy and another type of drug that helps suppress the nausea. There's a lot of different routes that folks are trying to investigate and what in terms of what the best route is for some of those side effects.
So, Lauren, you talked about one of the side effects being that if you go off the drug, people are being shown to gain the weight back. For what reason are they gaining the weight back? Is it because they're level of consumption just goes back up? Or is there some other related reason? Because we do know to a certain degree that obesity is not just created by eating a lot of food, even though it appears with this drug that people lose weight because they stop eating food because they no longer crave it. But is there really some other reason behind all of this, both the weight loss and the weight gain?
Yeah, and I honestly think that's where a lot of the fascination for me, where some of this addiction research falls into play, because it really taps into this understanding of like food reward behavior systems. So maybe like one of my evolutionary biologist sort of experts, I'll basically quote him, but he was explaining like, these drugs might be explaining to us that maybe there's something a little stretched in that reward system in people who are obese or overweight or have a really difficult time managing their weight or managing their food intake. Like maybe there's something there where that reward system is just a little bit skewed off to the side that's causing them to want to eat so much. I found that really interesting. I think there needs to be more, you know, research confirming some of these hypotheses, but I do think that these drugs are revealing a new understanding of what obesity means. I'll quote another one of my researchers who basically was saying that these drugs are really helping us change the conversation around obesity and diabetes too, not being just you know, a disease of the, you know, the pancreas or whatever. It's actually a neurobiological disease that it is, you know, centered in the brain. So I think there's a lot of interesting questions going around, and these drugs are kind of unfolding them and stuff. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, that answers my question, but it also brings up another or many other questions, which I'm sure it's the same with you as you go deeper and deeper into this research. But has anyone been prescribed Ozempic or Segovy or any of these for reasons other than diabetes and weight loss? For example, you know, someone with a gambling addiction, have they ever been prescribed it for their addiction?
Right. Yeah. It's a little too early for addiction. So actually, a lot of the addiction research and trials are ongoing. Patricia Grigson at Penn State University is doing some really interesting research on opioid addiction, actually, where she's combining one of the slightly earlier generations of GLP-1 drugs with opioid medication. And the way that opioid addiction is treated right now is by using a medication that is in itself an opioid. So it can cause that craving. And so by using something like GLP-1, she's hoping that it could help, you know, mitigate that craving from the treatment itself. And she actually saw, I think it was like a 40% drop in cravings for those that trial. But it's a little too early. You know, there hasn't been any like FDA-approved treatment for this, for addiction specifically. But there are several trials ongoing. And I think actually Novo Nordisk Novartis, which is the manufacturer of Ozempic and Wegovy, they're currently doing some trials on liver disease and in conjunction investigating how the drug might affect alcohol consumption or alcohol addiction. So there's definitely a lot of trials going on. So not yet in terms of prescribing someone these medications, but I think that is maybe down the line. In terms of other conditions that the drugs have been approved for, recently, it was actually just recent this past fall, the FDA approved Wegovy, which is the weight loss version of Ozempic, for cardiac health conditions. So they did approve it for that. So that's, you know, it's interesting seeing that how many parts of the body this drug seems to be affecting. And there was another study actually recently too that showed promise too for even kidney disease. So I'm a little bit hesitant because as a journalist, I'm always skeptical because right now a lot of the research is making it sound like this is a miracle drug that can solve everything. But I do think that there is a ceiling and researchers are very aware of some of the setbacks, like some of those side effects with the GI symptoms, the, you know, the experience of regaining weight or, you know, the treatment basically subsiding or going away once you stop taking the drugs. So I think there are a lot of limitations too, in addition to all these like new advances.
Well, we will be very interested in seeing your forthcoming articles on the topic. I assume that you're going to continue in this thread because you're this far into it and you have all these researchers that are feeding you their information. And you as a science writer and journalist can really translate that in for the masses, for lay people, which is wonderful and what Scientific American does so well.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And this has been really fun. And hopefully this was helpful and informative for your listeners.
Absolutely. Lauren Young is our guest. Her recent article in Scientific American is titled Ozempic Quiets Food Noise in the Brain, But How? And it is a great read. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Our next guest is a scuba diving philosopher, Peter Godfrey Smith. He shares a story of life on Earth told with living beings in the driver's seat. It is an awe-inducing exploration of how 3.7 billion years of organisms have fundamentally transformed our planet. From octopus dens and coral reefs to the forest habitats of bowerbirds in Australia and mountain gorillas in Rwanda. It's a journey not to be missed. Peter Godfrey Smith joins us this morning to explore what he has experienced firsthand. His new book is called Living on Earth, Forests, Corals, Consciousness, and the Making of the World. Peter, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with who you are, Peter. You're a professor in the School of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney. I'm not quite sure I've ever heard of a program called the Philosophy of Science. Tell us more.
Sure. I'm a philosopher. That's my day job. That's what I was trained in. And I've spent most of my career in philosophy departments, which are more familiar. But there are some universities that have both. They have a philosophy department and they have history and philosophy of science or something similar to that, where the idea is to be taking a humanistic view, historical and philosophical, but with a special interest in science. In the US, some examples of very good programs of that kind are at Indiana and Irvine. So there are, it's not just a Sydney quirk. It started at Sydney as a kind of political, I think there's a story there, perhaps for another day. There was political shenanigans that were involved in setting it up. But the idea is to think about science from a historical and philosophical point of view.
Well, that makes all kinds of sense. And it's funny, I just had to include in there in the intro, the scuba diving philosopher, because for anyone who has ever snorkeled or, you know, put on a mask or a scuba tank underneath the water, you do get this sense of awe and, you know, sort of, it makes you go to this bigger picture of life and existence. I think that everyone, I mean, it's a ubiquitous feeling when you look under the water. How did you first get interested in the world underneath the water?
I think awe is the right word. I think that's exactly how it is experienced in my case. And I think, as you say, in many people's cases, I always did, not always, but for a long time did a little bit of scuba diving recreationally when I was younger, mostly in Australia. But I didn't take it that seriously. I didn't do very much of it. And then about 15 years ago now, I began spending a bit more time in Australia. I was working in the US. I've worked at a number of American universities and would come back to Australia in the summers, northern summers, and began spending time in the water in a particular patch of water, not far from, very close to where I'm speaking to you from, actually, which is a tiny marine reserve. It's really very small, just a small bay. It's only a recent reserve, set up a bit over 20 years ago, and I just happened to begin first snorkeling in this area when I was back to visit, and began to encounter firstly giant cuttlefish and then octopuses. And they changed everything for me, pretty much. I was fascinated with their behavior, with the color changes, with the fact that these animals are quite inquisitive in some cases. They seem interested in humans in the same kind of way that we're interested in them. And they also are separated from us in evolutionary terms by this enormous gulf, this huge span of time, something close to 600 million years. You know, the common ancestor that you share with an octopus is right back near the earliest parts of animal life, not the earliest parts of life, but the earliest parts of animal life. So they're distant from us in that sense, but they can make contact with us in real time as you're there in the water. And it was irresistible to then start thinking about them, spending as much time as possible with them, learning about them. And that was the beginning of the three books, of which this is the final one.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a conversation with scuba diving philosopher and author Peter Godfrey Smith. We are talking about his latest book, Living on Earth, Forest Coral Consciousness and the Making of the World. Well, Peter, so many of us like to delineate life, human life, animal life, microscopic life, plant life. What is your definition of life? Do you see life as one continuous?
I think, okay, this is a very interesting topic and one that I just touch on in the book. I think that life, as it's turned out, is not a unified set of features or properties. There's not a kind of single kind of spark that matter acquires when it becomes alive. There's roughly two kinds of features that tend to go together but don't always go together. There's the metabolic side, which is the ability that living things have to keep themselves going, taking in raw materials, maintaining their structure, resisting the universe's forces of perennial decay. There's that side, and that's life on a sort of short time span. That's, you know, minute by minute, hour by hour. And then there's the evolutionary side that involves reproduction, or things similar to reproduction. That's a different kind of property. And some things have the first kind of property and not the second, and some things have the second kind of property and not the first. For example, viruses don't have a metabolism, but they have that, they have the reproductive side of life in, you know, in full-fledged form. And I think there's been a kind of partial deflation of the concept of life that has been part of the growth of our understanding, such that when we look at things and ask if they're alive, it's now natural to break that into a couple of questions, mostly two questions. The question about, does the system keep itself going? And does the system reproduce and enter into evolutionary processes? That's how I think about life.
Well, one of the main focuses of your book is the idea of consciousness. And I think as humans, it's so easy for us to separate ourselves from life, from most forms of life, because, well, that plant isn't conscious, that snail isn't conscious. Why have we done that? Was that a self-preservation mode to separate ourselves?
Well, it's something that a lot of people haven't really done. I mean, if you look at non-Western cultures, if you look at earlier stages in the history of Western culture, there's often been a lot more continuity asserted between forms of life that within the mainstream Western tradition have been seen as very sharply different. Even just staying within the Western side, Aristotle's view, Aristotle recognized a kind of soul present even in plants. And he thought that all living things have a kind of soul. What makes humans different is we have a rational soul as well as the other kinds, but plants have a kind of soul. So in a way, I think the situation is one where a fairly natural tendency to recognize continuity has been interrupted and fractured, especially within the Western tradition, by dualistic views that assert very sharp divides between mind and matter. I mean, Descartes is often the culprit associated with that shift, but not just him. I think, in a way, what we're doing in the present time is correcting a mistake that, understandably, but it was a mistake, was imposed in some earlier centuries.
That's really interesting. As you're talking, it makes me think about, as a child, I remember hearing that if you talk to your plants, they will be healthier. And as a child, that really induces that curiosity and that awe again. But do you feel that, I don't know, it maybe goes hand in hand with why some people just can't accept this climate change concept, that it's just so big and that it's much easier for us to not think about things like, oh, a plant has a soul, or this climate is changing due to our actions, that we just, it's sort of about self-preservation, kind of like what Katie was alluding to.
The plant question, I think, is very interesting in its own right, even before we think about those connections to other big issues. In the second book in the series, which is called Metazoa, I grapple with the question of whether plants have experiences, whether there's a kind of faint glimmer of consciousness in plants as well as in animals. I've forgotten if it was you or Katie who mentioned snails a minute ago, but I think snails are a good example of animals that are in a kind of true borderline region right at the moment with respect to what it's reasonable to suspect. You know, I think more than likely it feels like something to be a snail. They're not just little squishy robots, but they're really in the borderline region because their nervous systems are small. Now, from there, it's natural to think about, you know, where we go next, what we say about plants, fungi, bacteria, and so on. In the book Metazoa, after a certain amount of, I would have to admit, hand-wringing and uncertainty, I suggest that plants are out, that nervous systems are special. Only animals have nervous systems. Plants don't have them. They have internal signaling systems, which are very interesting and complex. But the bet that I make is they have a kind of cognitive side. You know, they process information. I think it's fair to say that. I would suggest that you can do that without having any awareness, and that's where plants, perhaps unlike snails, end up. So that's where I go with the plants. The idea that there's a connection between our inability to broaden our view there and our inability to broaden our view in a way that takes in human effects on the climate and that sort of thing. I'm curious to hear more about that, because the connection wasn't completely apparent to me when you asked the question. In the intro, you said, you described the book Living on Earth as putting organisms, or putting life, in the driver's seat. And I think that's a very good way to describe it. That's a nice way of picking up the kind of perspective that I'm encouraging. And that connects to climate change, I agree, because we have to think about the effects that we're having on these apparently very large, apparently impervious, but not really impervious systems. But maybe you could say a bit more about how that connected, the two questions?
Well, I think I was making the connection that things that just seem so big, so much bigger than us. I mean, this is what you're trying to do, like you say in the book, put us in the driver's seat so that we don't turn away from these questions, whether it's something as small as a plant has soul and I should speak to my house plants lovingly, and, you know, a question as big as climate change. That's kind of the connection I was making.
Okay, just the scale, just the the kind of shift in our thinking that involves zooming out and seeing things on a different scale. Yeah, okay, I see that.
And, you know, tying into that, you know, I wanted to kind of get into some more specifics for our listeners. A few things that jumped out to me were when you talked about the octopus den and seeing octopus. Oh, what is the plural of octopus? Is it octopuses? Octopi?
Octopuses is okay. Fine, especially these days. I mean, octopi is the controversial one because it would be a Greek plus Latin blend, which is, I think, regarded as dubious. Whereas octopuses is just, let's just treat it as English, basically.
Oh, boy. I'm glad I asked the question. No wonder it's so confusing. But, you know, looking back a handful of years to that documentary that came out, My Octopus Teacher, was it?
Yeah.
And I feel like that connected people so much to something like an octopus. But I'd love to hear a bit more about you and your experience in an octopus den or looking into one.
Okay, that was a beautiful film. I agree. It's remarkable. Perhaps I could say a bit about the most recent work we've done that has a kind of, it has a scientific side. There's a scientific paper about this. And it does connect to this book, To Living on Earth. This is a behavior that we've seen at the site called Octopolis, which is a high density site, an unusual site off the coast of Australia, further south than where I am now. And actually, before I go on, I should say this site has not been the same since COVID for some reason. I don't think that the octopus has had a particular COVID problem, but it just coincided with a decline in the site. So a lot of what I'm talking about here, this is stuff we saw about 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, but we're hoping the site will bounce back. Anyway, having said that, so you have lots of octopuses, up to a dozen or 14 in a small area, and they're continually messing around, improving their dens, clearing debris out of their dens. And sometimes this involves just carrying some shells and dumping them. And sometimes it involves a kind of jet-propelled throw where the octopuses gather a bunch of stuff in their arms and they bring their jet propulsion device underneath the arms and let loose a blast of water and release the stuff with their arms at the same time. So you get this really pretty spectacular, as I say, a jet-propelled throw of material. Now, that's interesting in itself. But we began to see some cases of this where the throw hit another octopus. And then, of course, it was irresistible to start wondering, okay, are they trying to do that? Is this a situation where the octopuses are trying to target other octopuses with this stuff? We wrote a paper about this, and I don't want to suggest anything as conclusive. It's very hard to work out. I mean, it's hard to work out in more familiar animals when they throw things or project things, what they're trying to do. With an octopus, my God, it's much harder. But we think some of the throws are targeted. It's mostly females who throw stuff and hit other octopuses. It's often males who are kind of bothering them, to use informal language. And we think it's a kind of, in some cases, a kind of assertion of personal space on the part of female octopuses. Now, this is it's a fascinating behavior. It also relates to the themes of this book because it's a kind of tool use. You're using one object to have an effect on something else. You know, you're gathering stuff and you're throwing it, if we're right, to assert personal space against or over against another octopus. Now, tool use is quite rare in the sea. It's not something you see a whole lot of in the sea. There are very smart animals in the sea that don't do a lot of it, even though they're smart enough to do it. but their bodies don't really cooperate. I mean, dolphins do a little bit of tool use. They use sponges to probe the seafloor in some cases and things like that. But tool use and its relative, which is kind of re-engineering the environment, it becomes a lot more marked when animals come up onto land. Land is kind of the natural home for those sorts of behaviors. So in the case of this octopus debris throwing, get out of my face behavior, you have a rare case of tool use in the sea by an invertebrate animal. The kind of thing that is, it's hard in the sea. Behaviors like that are really difficult in the sea, throwing stuff, hammering stuff, building stuff. And one of the things I think that the move onto land made possible is a kind of ramping up of the kind of transformation of environments that involves choice rather than just the actions of your body, the chemical effects of your body and so on.
Well, Peter, you were part of the New York Declaration on Consciousness. Tell us about that.
Sure. That was put together as a sort of short statement a few months ago. I was a signatory and I had a small role in the discussions, but I wasn't one of the people who wrote it. And the intention was to make a statement that asserts a broader picture of the category of animals where there's a realistic possibility that they have some kind of experience, that they're conscious in a minimal sense. Now, that term, realistic possibility, was carefully chosen. It's not that we think that all these animals definitely are conscious, that we know this, that it's for sure. No one knows. But there's a category of animals which is surprisingly big, includes octopuses, quite a few crustaceans, lobsters, crabs, and so on. And the surprising case to me, which is some insects, especially bees, where the evidence now makes it look as if it's fair to say there's a realistic possibility that these are conscious animals. The statement made a claim of that sort, and then a very cautious second statement along the lines of, you know, when there's a realistic possibility that an animal's conscious, we shouldn't ignore that fact when we make decisions about it. That was the declaration. And there's I've forgotten how many people have now signed it, but it's fairly large number of people, mostly scientists, also some people like me who are more philosophers than scientists. And the point of it was not to kind of push the debate along by making a public appeal. The point of it, at least as I saw it, was to make public a sense that a lot of people have. Just sort of say it in a way that would be more visible to the wider population, because I think that a lot of people probably think that the idea that crabs or octopuses or honeybees are conscious, they might think that's just a really fringe idea, a sort of really out there idea. And the point of a declaration was to say, well, it might not be true, but it's not an out there idea.
Well, Peter, one of the things you focus on in the book, and I think is a really thing for all humans to understand, is, again, we are so good at othering ourselves from all other life, but we can't do that any longer, especially as, you know, first world civilizations. So where do we go from here to ensure the longevity of life on this planet, even if that means that humans possibly die out as part of the natural evolutionary process?
Right. We can't ignore the situation anymore. I think that's exactly right. There's two chapters in the book that talk about policy questions and looking forward, where the first of those chapters is about questions that don't relate so much to our future, but just to the causal role that we have now. And there I talk about farming, factory farming, industrialized farming, and also the use of animals in experiments. And especially in the second case, I argue that there should be a pretty dramatic shift in our behaviors in this area. Well, in both cases. I guess in the second case, the view I take is a bit, perhaps a bit more surprising or a bit more controversial in the context of other discussions of this topic. That's one chapter. And the other chapter in this general area talks about the future and our effects on the Earth going forward, where the two topics discussed there in most detail are climate change and habitat destruction, the need to protect habitats. There I argue that I think it would be good if there was a little bit of a reweighting of priorities. I worry a little bit that climate change dominates environmental discussions so much now that the more kind of, in a sense, old-fashioned goal of habitat preservation, preventing extinctions, preventing forests being cut down, and that sort of thing, those sorts of goals are being sidelined because everyone's eyes are on climate change. So in that chapter, I discuss the relationship between the two problems, which I agree are certainly connected, but press a little bit for a stronger emphasis on habitat preservation. When I look at the loss of species and just the loss of numbers of various kinds of animal that have been reported recently, it's very alarming. The loss of birds, the loss of insects, numbers are going down very sharply. Things like that are affected by climate change, but it's a different problem. It's a problem that needs to be understood in its own right.
Yeah. Well, the book is Living on Earth, Forests, Corals, Consciousness, and the Making of the World. It's an important book and also a really captivating one to read. So, Peter Godfrey Smith, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.
And be sure and tune in next week for a couple of fascinating conversations. We will talk about math for English majors and how we can all approach math as more of a language and not something to be absolutely terrified of. And then we have a great conversation with New York Times bestselling author David Lipsky about the climate of denial in science and climate science. And it was a fascinating conversation, one that we can all relate to and all understand our role in the discussion around climate change and other important scientific topics.
Yes, and thanks for tuning in. Yeah, that conversation will be David Lipsky. Again, a fascinating conversation. You've been listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Thanks for tuning in.